Hello, and welcome to recording number 21 of Gary Gygax's Saga of Old City, an annotated reading. I'm going to restart here on page 148, and it is paragraph 2. Both men sat back a bit and enjoyed their contentment. The wench, Amy, brought them fresh goblets, filled this time with an emerald-colored elvish wine, whether from Selene or Ulloch, Gord neither knew or cared. As the wine was poured, the boy hastily removed their bowls, for Tob was at hand with a brace of squabs for each. Birds were roasted to perfection, juicy and stuffed with green grapes. When the tiny bones were picked clean, and the last globe of fruit devoured, Gord thought no prince or king had ever dined so well. Geller, in contrast, seemed only mildly satisfied, telling their host that so far all had been acceptable. So far, that made Gord wonder, but not for long. The elvish wine was whisked away in favor of a deep, ruby-hued wine served to them in chalices. Gord imitated Geller's actions as the one-eyed thief swirled and sniffed the stuff. The aroma was heady and tantalizing. Gord sipped and found the flavor full, strong, and impossible to describe. Just as one flavor seemed to come to mind, the vintage moved a different part of his palate to identify another taste, and when he let the last of it pass down his throat, still another sensation filled his mouth. Then a vast dish filled with mutton and legumes, seasoned with garlics and herbs, was placed before them, and both fell to. Gord more from the appetizing odor and appearance of the dish than from hunger for it. Could it be that this course was even better than the previous one? Neither man could possibly finish these last portions served, and when the remainder was cleared, both belched and grinned. As if by magic, small plates with various sorts of greens were placed before them. Gord's nose detected vinegar, fine oil, and pepper. Geller speared the leafy bits and ate them with relish, and Gord followed suit. The stuff was tasty and removed the greasy mutton aftertaste from his mouth. Soon the plate was clear of all but a few stray bits of parsley and cress. At last they were finished, thought Gord, but he was mistaken once again. The astonished Gord was served a trencher of thin white bread, a dozen cheeses were put before them, and a crock of butter placed between the pair. As more wine was poured, Geller said, "Tub, you continue to amaze me, I must admit. Where did you find these wonderful cheeses? I haven't seen their like in years." Tub only beamed and hurried off to serve his other customers. Geller enlightened Gord as to the nature of several of the small wheels and rounds on the table. One was a goat cheese from far to the west, Ket actually. Another one with great holes and a sharp, vaguely nutty flavor was Perrenlander. Still another was creamy and delicious, but very smelly. One made by the Fruse tea known as Jekyll for the town of its origin. Best of all, Gord liked an ivory-colored cheese with greenish marbling through its center. His companion informed him it was called Wickler from the yeomanry. Just after this array came some diminutive tarts of various sort, berry, nut, and mincemeat. At last it was really over, and the thoroughly stuffed patron sipped brandy and groaned. "How could such a place exist?" Gord demanded of Geller. "And how came you to find it? Never have I eaten such." The one-eyed man smiled sardonically and shrugged. No, tell me." "Come on, my boy," he replied. "Think you seriously that everyone here has always been a lowly thief, or always dwelt in such a pest hole as Stoink?" Ruminating on the full meaning of those remarks, Gord joined Geller in a stroll around Hall Droon to settle their mirror, meal and work off its attendant lethargy. After all, they had come here for more than a banquet. Break. Well, I wish that, most role-playing games, that the encounters had as much flavor and feeling and atmosphere as this little bit about Gord and Geller eating at this inn. It's really amazing how much you can see that the game can really be improved by the flavor text. Yeah, and the details on like the cheeses and the entire meal. You can see that Gygax had this idea for the setting that really, it implies a lot of things. The kinds of things like, they have brandies and they have all these different wines, and there's all these attendant crafts that have to go with it. So we can see then that Ulluk and Selene, Furyundi, they all have places where they are growing grapes and making wines. Then we have the business about these various cheeses. And very funny, Perrinland with its Perrinlander cheese. So that it really tells you what Gygax was thinking about, how he had always taken the various places within the setting and used similar ideas from historical Switzerland for Perrinland. And so here's a whole bunch of different, different things. Like I wouldn't even have thought of having the goat cheese from Ket and, the Fruze tea, having a making cheeses and stuff. And yet that adds into every area, it starts fleshing it out. And it's just little comments like this. Now, we get some setting information. I don't know if everybody would want to run their game quite like this. That meal, it wasn't... like a medieval sounding meal. And finally out of this that I get the idea that Haldrun must be, for all its rowdy wildness, they're walking around that village, village of Haldrun, where it's all the mercenaries and humanites and stuff. And although they're both very experienced at this point, it sounds generally safer than, say, like the slum quarters, or it sounds safer than a lot of places in the city of Greyhawk.
And I think initially Gord said that the suburbs weren't nearly as nice as the city, or at least that's what he thought.
That is very interesting. It also implies then that with the city of Greyhawk, that outside the walls there should also be, I think outside the walls of the city of Greyhawk there should also be, these villages, and because more than even just the farming communities and stuff, there'd be safety and there'd be places where the crops would be gathered and stuff. And it's the same here with Stoink, and Stoink, although as a city size, it's much, much smaller than the city of Greyhawk, it still sounds like it's a pretty big place. There's a lot that goes into it if they are commonly having places like in Haldrun here, where they have this, amazing inn with it, like a little five-star restaurant there.
Yeah, it sounds like you can get pretty much anything you want in Stoink. They might not make it there, but they have it.
Yeah, and so Stoink, you know, I really see Stoink being developed as this, you know, trading market town. Maybe something a little like New Orleans was, you know, where, you know, pirate goods were brought and things were being brought down river. You know, down the Mississippi, there were all the, you know, the trappers and fur coming down the Mississippi and all the shipping coming in because New Orleans was a big port. And there was a big, I don't know how true it is. I've seen various popular movies where they depicted the, you know, the 1820s New Orleans as a, you know, a place where there was a big mixture of honest merchants and piratry and, you know, where the honest merchants would go out and they would buy the goods. But in Stoink, buy the goods from the pirates. But in Stoink, you can just go out and it's right there. So all of Stoink is, it sounds like it is a really, because it is a really good resource for all these merchants and things to be coming and meeting at Stoink, getting things and trading off things that they couldn't in more, you know, organized lands or more honest lands. So it really, I think Stoink, you know, and Stoink may be the largest of the Bandit Kingdom cities. I know that some are very small. Now, the city itself is supposed to only be about, I think, 14,000, which, you know, is a big enough city. But some of the Bandit Kingdom cities, I believe, were much smaller.
I remember, I think yesterday, they mentioned that the whole area, the metropolitan area or the city state was about 70,000.
Yes, and that would mean that if Stoink itself as the city, I don't know if that concluded Haldroon and Ratswarf, which are the villages outside of it. I think that they imply that there's a lot of land that is controlled by Stoink.
There's a big bend below Stoink in the Arkansame, so maybe that's some kind of fertile crescent or something. I'm only guessing, but I mean, it would make sense because geographically Stoink would bottleneck entrance to it, for, at least from the north.
Yeah, and you know, as being pointed out here in the text, Stoink, you know, they talked about Lukesh and Radagast City. Which seems to be at a particularly good place because it's at the mouth of the Artansame. But Stoink seems to be, as it's described, even more active than that, even more a vibrant city of crafting and you know, like the thievery and banditry within Stoink itself seems very minor. Because as we saw that the Thieves Guild is... You know, the Thieves Guild in Stoink seems very formalized, tame.
Yeah, when he was saying it's a poor place to make a dishonest drab or something.
Yes, and you know, that is very interesting that here we have a bandit kingdom where people are coming and, you know, selling everything. You know, a real open city. And yet, at the same time, it seems to be a city of, because it's ruled by... probably Boss Daly as a despot, the mayor, Boss Daly, that Stoink itself seems to be under firm control. And that, you know, like, he has, it's mentioned that all of the most worthwhile places to rob are under the protection of Boss Daly. So they're paying a tax or protection fee to the boss, and then they don't have to worry about the thieves robbing them without retribution coming from, you know, the guards and the watch that are under the control of Boss Daly. Even though there's an open thieves guild that isn't under his direct control, it still seems like Stoink must be, and this is why, Stoink must be a real hub. You know, it is. It really seems like it is the center of trade in the near dev, probably because you could say that doesn't sound like there's anything not allowed, so that you can come there, and even if you're generally an honest merchant or a citizen of the Pale or Nirond or County of Ernst, or even from anywhere around the near dev and around the bandit kingdoms, that you can go to Stoink to sell everything that you couldn't sell anywhere else.
Yeah, and they probably handle all the goods stolen from the Pale, which they mentioned was fairly wealthy.
Yeah, and and then on the other hand, the Pale seems to have its seamier side, whether it's in the open or not. And then you would get the people in the Pale who, like they might be wealthy for various reasons. It's, it's a real shame that Gygax never got the Stoink done, even in a sketchy form. I mean, I would love to see Gygax have sketched out the city with a map, like he did with City of Hawks, even a very primitive map, and then done, an outline of what was in Stoink, because he had a real touch for that, and it really is enjoyable to see. I don't think if he had done Stoink or the City of Greyhawk like he talked about, that it would have been as detailed, and I think it would not have bound other DMs very much. I think it would have just been a general outline of what you could expect. I would love to see that, and I can see where this is a wonderful area to adventure in.
It really stirs the imagination.
Yeah, and that is one of the powerful things about Saga of the Old City and the other books that Gygax has written, is that I don't think there's anywhere else that so far has detailed the Rene, the Atloy, or now Stoink. And, if we see how much Lukesh and Radagast City are very vague, very vague, you can see that there's a lot of detail put into Stoink right here.
Yeah, we have 9 districts, we have street names, we have restaurants that are outfitted with world-class foods, cheeses from everywhere, yeomanry, Wickler, all that stuff.
And descriptions of crafts and, the villages outside and this a general atmosphere that's being described. No, I see this as a place that should be as heavily used, I think, as City of Greyhawk in a campaign.
Yeah, it would be a fun place to run. There's a lot of similarities, but there's some differences too.
And I hear complaints that, like, there's nothing to do in Nirond.
Yeah, well, you can rob it.
Yeah, but here with Stoink, there's a lot of ideas that would spread from Nirond to Stoink. Mm-hmm. And, also, I think in general that there is not a... In Gygax's Greyhawk, and in this Gygax's Greyhawk setting that's more like the published version that he's talking about here, I don't think that any of the states are as bland as they're kind of made out for. I think everything, this is an adventuresome world, and I think that if on the surface it might appear to be, like a well-organized or peaceful state, or even a little boring like the Pale, I think that if you scratch the surface, that there is going to be adventure to be found. And that's the intention, is that DMs should look at the setting and really have it where there's always going to be, look behind the door, look behind look behind the tapestry, look behind the curtain, and you're going to find something there.
What's really going on.
Yeah, and I know that there's a lot of talk about the Greyhawk Wars, but I think that is also something where you're going to see that what should have been done is that it should have been how, instead of earth-shattering stuff, it should have been something where, like we're discovering with Stoink, that there's a depth and something that the characters can really get involved in. I would have loved to see that as well. All right. I am going to restart, and we're on chapter 16, page 150. We're getting very close to halfway through the book. We're starting at paragraph 1. Near midnight, they entered the Double Dagger. The rundown building was packed with roistering men, and no one noticed two more of the same sort when they entered. The hall was long and relatively narrow. Gord and Geller spent a fair amount of time slowly working their way from front to rear, pausing now and then to get fresh flagons and join briefly in a conversation or a game. If anything, the tavern became more crowded with the passage of time. But while there were many patrons, there were few worthy of attention from pickpocket or cutpurse. Risky detection for the sake of gaining sufficient money to merely supply themselves with drinks during the exercise seemed foolish and wasteful. Gord was just getting ready to suggest that they move on to some more promising place when a group of loud and laughing newcomers attracted his attention. The young thief knew that their boisterousness was by design, not from excess drink, although most observers would deem it otherwise. Gord signaled to Geller, and the pair moved closer to see what was going to happen. The newcomers were soon dispersed along the length of the place, joking, buying drinks, and talking. A bit of eavesdropping revealed that the fellows were ostensibly recruiting for their brigade of mercenaries. The sum being offered for enlistment, a lucky ahead, was almost too good to be true. And vague promises of little fighting and much loot were too general to be real. That the recruiting was actual, however, could not be doubted, for a score or more were convinced and left with some of the newly arrived men to enlist immediately and get the coin, which would buy them another 100 drinks, or a wench, a jug, and plenty left for another carouse. Break. I'm always intrigued by the value of coinage in Gygax's books and setting here. So Electrum is going to be good for 100 drinks, a woman, a jug, and plenty of left over. So that is just amazing. That we know that an Electrum is 10% of a gold piece, that's absolutely amazing. So I guess it would be 100 bronzes for the lucky, and 100 bronzes, so 100 drinks and left over for another carouse. So the value of a bronze Z in Stoink here would probably be about like half a Z for a drink. And, I don't know what the brass bits conversion is and stuff, but that's just, that is amazing. That gives you another thing where we can compare, the game value of an actual item to the value of these coins. We've got another building being described here, which I would guess is in Haldrun, because they haven't said that they've left Haldrun, so they're still out in the village. And again, although they're in a big gambling place, there's just really not enough value for pickpocketing or purse cutting that Gord sees that would make it worth even to buy a few drinks, which is just a few, like I said, it'd be just a few bronze Z. So the average patron here doesn't look like they have a lot of money. All right, I am going to restart. We are on page 151. It is paragraph 2. Geller signaled to Gord to carefully watch the apparent leader, one who referred to himself as Flatchet. That one and two others who looked like lieutenants spent most of their time asking casual questions and listening attentively to the slurred replies, prompting now and then and directing. That was indeed of note. The pair moved closer, feigning being fairly under the weight of much strong ale. Soon both were part of a circle of people discussing the affairs of the free lords, as the rulers of the petty bandit states referred to themselves, and particularly the recent incursions of the Horn Society into Warm Hall and War Fields, the two westernmost territories of the bandit kingdoms, which were both currently occupied by forces beholden to the evil hierarchs. After the assemblage gave forth a smattering of oaths of vengeance upon these dreaded masters of the Horn Society, talk turned to criticism of the desultory nature of the warfare being waged, ostensibly for the purpose of dislodging the invaders and impaling the puppet rulers they had placed over the conquered territories. Break. We're introduced here to the Horn Society and the Hierarchs, which are the leaders, and happen to be one of my favorite evil nation states right there. They talk a little about Warm Hall and War Fields, I believe, in the Bandit Kingdoms, and I believe neither one are too, I didn't think that either was very sizable. In my own campaign, I do have them as linked to the Horn Society, but mainly because they are, their place where there's war going on against the Shieldlands, and the Shieldlanders in my campaign don't particularly like the Bandit Kingdom. So having the Horn Society have taken over two of the Bandit Kingdoms, and some kind of plan or a warfare right now, that is of desultory nature, that does fit into the kind of Greyhawk Wars campaign. And I it's one of the reasons why I was mentioning it, is that that here we have something where it could be like the Greyhawk Wars, but at the same time, it's still not like wiping out things out and changing things a great deal. Not sure now. Here's a question about Bad Wall, but I'm not real familiar with it offhand, looking at its location or anything. I don't know. I believe that in Dragon Magazine, in Where the Bandits Are, there might be some details on military forces or even general population of the various named bandit kingdoms. There's a question here about Haldrune and the inn or restaurant or tavern run by Tubb. It is very interesting. It must be, I believe, like a members only club for officers, because everyone there is described as being clean with nice armor. And not the kind of thing you'd see from, the general. Like here we're seeing a place, the Double Dagger is obviously a much lower class gambling establishment where something like the place where Tubb was, I can't remember if it was named offhand, that it is, seems to be a much higher class place. We get that the bandit kings are calling themselves the free lords, we've got two more kingdoms named, if not detailed, but there is I do like in this last paragraph that we get the idea of larger campaigns and use of the mercenaries, and it does fit in with adventuring or what you'd expect to encounter around Haldrune.
Yeah, there's a lot of action and Warm Hall and War Fields in the Bandit Kingdoms are besieged, if not taken over, right? They're taken over, I guess.
Yeah, and they do have puppet rulers rather than direct conquest. So both Warfields and Warm Hall they're both have these leaders who are, you know, they're puppet leaders for the Hierarchs, but still the Horn Society and the Hierarchs haven't just come in and, you know, claimed the territory and set it up. They're using puppets, which tells you, you know, it speaks to something about the strength maybe of the Horn Society,
and the way they like to operate.
Yes, and now there's one more thing that I wanted to comment. There's a running theme has been about disguise and concealment and recognition. Mm. Now, here again, we have this business with these mercenary recruiters. And right away, Gordon Geller spot what seems to be odd about them. They're offering too much money. Neither Gord or Geller really believe that something isn't going on beyond just recruiting for mercenaries. So again, one of the pot themes running through the book is about these cons and disguises and about people of higher level or just greater skills being able to being able to spot these things. And that I think is also something that you could it's like the ability to spot a trap door or sloping ground. And in here for a thief, I think one of the things that I haven't seen listed but would be a good player background or skill is the ability to spot cons and to recognize disguises. And, I would think that if we were looking at statistics, intelligence and wisdom would probably be a benefit to such skills. So you can have it where the characters, are at some inn. Then, like the thief in the party, he's watching, something causes him to watch some character and he notices a cup purse, or he notices that somebody's not acting right or properly, or he notices like secret signals being passed from one character to another. So you can use that where, the adventure can just be in some inn. I just think, it's really something that you can throw right out at the characters to add to the adventure.
Yeah, I think, if you wanted to use the existing stats, you might even be able to roll with fine traps or something like that.
Yeah. And, I think this is a really good, there's really good examples about detection. It's kind of like how Gord, obviously, that moved silently in the city wasn't the same or as effective in the wilderness when Gord got caught by the bandits.
Right.
So we can see that you can use these detection ability or skill to be able to start, to introduce an adventure idea. It's not always, you don't want to railroad people. Like, what you want to do is just say, the thief notices, that there seems to be some kind of pickpockets, or that he notices signals between several NPCs, within the inn or tavern or gambling hall. And then the players can choose to take that up or just, and it's gone. You know, they can just say, well, we're really not interested and we're going to let it go. And rather than try to hammer it in, the players don't want it to be their central theme, you can just bring that kind of thing up. And if the characters ignore it, they ignore it. You can do things where they get involved, whether they wanted to or not. But it's also nice to have the potential to say, well, we're going to do something other than the most obvious choice. It's always frustrating as a DM to, detail all these things and then have the characters just walk right past them. But I think it's if you prepare yourself, then you can offer up to the characters lots of potential for adventure, and not be stuck down to just one set path. And, of course, that's one of the problems with a lot of professional modules, is that they can't do much more than offer you one set path, and then it becomes like you're stuck in a book. Like here, it's very interesting to read what Gordon Geller are doing, but it would be better, you know, if you're playing it, that scenario, that Gordon Geller could just say, you know, if they're the player characters, they could just say, well, we see it, but we're not interested. We're going to do something else. And I like that much better than adventures where you're just forced down, you know, railroad path, that you only have one way forward. And but anyway, that business with discernment, I think, you know, is very good. Now, we have, taking a step back, the leader of this group is called Flatchet. Now, what we don't have is direct, it seems to be that that is what Geller and Gord have found out. And in a lot of books, they write in this omniscient viewpoint where you're given information, and that is the truth. But a lot of the, what's in this Gygax novel is that you're given truth from a point of view. Like we're hearing the truth as Gord and Geller have known it or assume it. And so it may not be what's really happening. So I'd assume, yes, that guy's name is Flatchet. But it seems like that is maybe, it could even be a pseudonym. It could be an alias, because that just seems to be what Geller and Gord have picked up, probably from the person introducing himself to potential recruits.
Now, you know they're thinking of robbing somebody. I'm wondering if they're going to rob him or they're going to rob the people who sign up.
Yeah, and it, you know, if we see that they are saying, if they don't have the coin on them, that Electrum, then they're saying that they have those Electrums somewhere, and that they've already got, a score, like 20 recruits already? And if they've that many, that's 20 Electrums. So that's getting to be, you know, a couple of gold orbs. And for this economy, that's quite a bit. That's not just stealing enough to pay for a few drinks or a dinner. You know, that is a sizable amount. And if they have 20 Electrum, do they have 50 or 100? Or, you know, do they have a pile of gold and platinum? So, you know, I don't know what they're planning, but it would seem, since Flatchet doesn't seem to be passing out the money right now, and that they're going someplace, it would seem that maybe they're planning on joining up so they can find out where the, you know, the bulk of this war chest happens to be.
Yeah, Gort's suspicious too, right? He doesn't necessarily believe them.
But, you know, like they did when Gord robbed the fences at that warehouse of the thieves,
mm-hmm.
back at Carpona, Gord is more than willing, you know, to turn a trick against the people running the con or the other thieves. He's, you know, he's always willing to take advantage of the other scams that are going on and the other thieves. You know, robbing from another thief is always like they were going to do to him when the bandits were going to steal from Gord. Gord's right. Always willing to take coin from other bandits and even his supposed friends, like he did when he left the city of Greyhawk.
That's true. I think Gord would do fine in Stoink. Creative enough to come up with things that other people don't think about and are not like on the don't list. So I think he would do well.
Yes, because Gord always seems to want to press his luck.
Right.
You know, he always wants to take things a little, you know, that you know, knows when to go far enough, but just goes that little bit more. And I think that, Gord, especially if they're not used to anybody robbing, you know, the protected places, then perhaps they might even be not as much on their guard as they should be.
Right.
All right, I am going to restart here. It is page 151, and it is paragraph 4. Then, with but a few words spoken with the air of one who knows, Flagitt planted in the listeners' minds the impression that it was the Tenna host, not the hierarchs of the Horn Society, that had really started the trouble. One of the bandits nodded agreement, stating that had the damned Tennites not brought their bun-blasting cavalry across the Zumker River, thus invading the sovereign bandit states of Grosskopf and Fellands to the northeast, then no trouble with the up till then friendly Horn Society would have occurred. Haw, one of the two lieutenants, asked why in hell everyone was mad at the hierarchs anyway. After all, the Black Duke of Ten held lands rightfully belonging to the Free Lords. The Sodder had started the trouble, gained from it, and was getting off Rover free, while two former allies fought one another. Agreement with this line of reasoning was emphatic and loud, and soon the whole place was passing the idea around and asking just what fighting with the hierarchs did but help enemies like Ernst, the Shieldlands, and the hated Tennites. This revelation seemed totally new to the bandits, and the effect it had was startling. Ord thought that before another day passed, there would be mutterings all the way to Ratswarf about taking vengeance upon the Duke instead of fighting with their virtual cousins from across the Retensa. Then the talk came round to Geller and Gord. Break. Well, I'm breaking here because, you know, that is a very interesting revelation. And obviously, I think it seems like maybe these are agents of the Horn Society. It's guesswork, but what I also liked was we have now naming, we've got two more of the bandit kingdoms, but we also have that the enemies of the bandit kingdoms are Ernst and the Tens and the Shield Knights. So, you know, that again puts the structure. Now, Ten, I would guess what is in the northeast of the bandit kingdoms. And there, you know, like they said, the kingdoms of Grosskopf and Fellands to the northeast. So here, you know, I mean, like I complain about the Greyhawk Wars, but here we do have showing that there are, you know, some large-scale warfare that's going on. I don't think, I rarely look at nation-conquering warfare here, but I think that that stirring things up on that scale, it opens up possibilities within the game that aren't just simple dungeon crawling and you know, inner city things. That once you open it up to warfare and mercenaries, it really is now adding a new component. And here we're given in Stoink a good recruiting ground, I guess, for mercenaries of dubious character. So maybe some of these wouldn't be the types that would be recruited, you know, toward the south and into more established kingdoms, or maybe not. You know, I mean, a lot of places will use mercenaries, you know, even, you know, various monstrous mercenaries, you know, just because they're available and they're not so tied down. If they can use something, they're not tied down to like an alignment morality. This setting is very, it's very open, and it seems to be very much that things happen, you know, outside of like you know, these aren't paladins, and these are not states with, for the most part, with, you know, a straight compass over everybody in the state or everybody ruling that state, and you're going to have various things going on. Like, I think if we look at the Duchy of Ernst and the County of Ernst, that we see that it seems like the duchy may even be piratical, you know, talking about how it was fighting with the Rene. So I really think that we're going to look that there's so much more depth to every one of these areas than, you know, we see in a lot of published releases where
things are a little, like the edges are a little smoothed off, and the things are a little more less complex, less deep, and more structured along that rigid alignment line. All right, I am going to continue here. And it is page 152, and it is paragraph 3. "You two seem pretty quiet," Fletchett noted. "How about allowing me the pleasure of refilling your jacks with our host's good ale and telling us your line of work?" Geller did not speak up right away. Gord was less reticent. "I am Gord," he said, "captain of a small company of freeswords, lately come here after visiting the Palish." Here he paused for a breath and grinned ruefully. "I was hoping to recruit a few men myself," he said. "The dirty dung-eaters of the Pale took a few good friends from our company. It seems that you're better equipped with speech and coin than I, so you observed me listening and learning." "What company is that?" Fletchett asked smoothly. "Ever hear of the Grey Beggars?" Gord offered. And Fletchett showed no immediate sign of recognition. He continued, "No, maybe you know some of the locals who were with us for a time. Finn, Bogadar." The questioner thought for a moment. "Finn, is he tall or a short one?" "Tall, and Bogadar had a lot of orcish in him. Hard to forget once you see him," Gord added with a touch of sarcasm. "Yeah, those two I've heard of, but not the company," said Fletchett. "No surprise," drawled Gord. "He came out of the Flinties, where the Gamebodge Forest meets him. Had to move north from there, though, because the Nirendees were getting pissed at our successes." "And you?" Fletchett asked, turning to Gord's companion. "Hey, I'm from Stoink, and I mind my own business," Geller snapped. "No need to get testy, friend," Fletchett said soothingly, while signaling for more ale. "I'm just trying to round up likely men for the brigade, and you look prime." Gord again took the interplay to himself. "Any bonus for officering and bringing a score or two of hardies?" he asked. "Veterans? Nothing but, and likely closer to 70 if the boys are having any luck recruiting over east. Round Onglewood and Blore. Triple shares for a captain and double for his right hand, plus a common ahead for every sword. Bring your Grey Beggars into the brigade and you'll get your coin." Gord looked pleased when Fletchett said that, and then nodded toward Geller. "My pal here is too modest," Gord began. "He's a hell of a scrapper and has other talents to boot. Besides all that, he could get you near a dozen as good. I'll bet, right, Geller? It's hard times in Stoink right now." The one-eyed thief looked sour at the suggestion, but said no word of denial. After pausing to give Geller a chance to respond, Fletchett pumped him for more information. "Do as good with a sword as your friend says," taking his cue from Geller's slow nod. Fletchett continued, "Can you get more like you?" "Shit, half the thieves and rakes in the town will follow my lead," said the one-eyed man. The one-eyed man said softly, "But why the hell should I want to go riding off with your brigade on some half-assed nothing of a raid into the blue?" "I think I can trust a pair like you," the stranger said, leaning closer and speaking in a conspiratorial tone with slurred tongue. Fletchett told them, "We are putting together a whole goddamn army, and we're gonna sack Redspan." Gord and Geller looked at each other in shock. That was a most unlikely plan. The town was heavily fortified, well garrisoned, and prepared to withstand siege. Besides, it was in 10, and who wanted a full-scale war with the able 10 a host? They turned to stare at Fletchett, whose upper body was now beginning to weave. His expression was comic, a cross between wonderment over having divulged secret information and puzzlement as though he was surprised over being so inebriated so quickly. The captain's eyes were beginning to cross, Gord knowing that it wouldn't be long before he was beyond conversation, spoke quickly and loud. "Done then, Flatchet. I'll bring you the Grey Beggars, and Cyclops here will also furnish as many as he can," he said. And as he clapped the fellow on the back in camaraderie, he added, "The 200 we can guarantee only if you sign us up now and advance a bit of coin." The other one of Flatchet's lieutenant was elsewhere. But Taw was nearby and listening carefully. He turned his full attention to their table when he heard the thud of Flatchet's head as the captain slumped into unconsciousness. "Come here and help us," Geller demanded of him. "This wily bastard has talked us into furnishing a full company, and now he's too loaded to sign us up and pay over the silver." As Taw came near, Gord asked, "You do have the money, don't you? We'd take it ill indeed if be lied to." Taw gave assurance of ability to pay, and with apologies for his captain's drunkenness, said he'd personally take care of the matter, providing that the two would help him get Flatchet safely to their bivouac nearby. They assisted, of course, and in a short time had managed to get the now comatose captain a few hundred paces to the shacks, the field nearby, where a collection of tents and hastily constructed shacks made up the recruiters' encampment area. From what was here, Gord surmised that the strength of the group already exceeded 600. Several pennons flapped idly in the breeze. It was too dark to identify them, but their presence did indicate that whole companies had been recruited. Perhaps they really did intend to attack Redspan. All right, now, here we've got a little description of the town of Redspan, heavily fortified, hopes to withstand a siege. If you get a chance, there is a detail map, and it shows that Redspan is, maybe a league or more north. I'm not sure the scale of Stoink. That is set in the Ten. And Gord talks about the strength of the Ten of Host and its cavalry, and how, again, even though there are they are actually recruiting, he still seems to think that, it doesn't seem likely. So at the very end, he looks at the size of the, 600, the size of their encampment with the several companies of men, and thinks that maybe they are going to attack Redspan. But still, it seems like, again, he is seeing through what is going on. Now, I don't know if I missed it, but it seems like they have spiked Flatchet's drink to render him unconscious.
Yeah, that's what good Gord's get. We even miss it.
Oh, did they mention it?
No, they didn't. I was saying he's getting that good that we didn't even notice it. I was trying to be funny, but I don't know.
Oh, okay. All right. Yeah. There's obviously Gord has hatched a plan. I'm not sure here if Geller is along with him. We see that Gord is very very quick, and there he immediately comes up that as soon as somebody presents and he needs to come up with something on the fly, he's there immediately coming up with the Grey Beggars. He's smart enough to mention Finn and Bogador, because there he can give physical descriptions, and that he is guessing incorrectly that they're known. It also says a little then about Flatchet, that Flatchet must have been in the area before, been to Stoink before, because how long were the bandits away from Stoink in their raids to end up where Flatchet? is familiar enough with Finn and Bogadore, you know, that they have had some kind of previous encounter or mention of them. So that, you know, is like, Flatchett then sounds like, I thought maybe he might be a direct agent of the Hierarchs, but now he sounds like he's already got experience with Stoink. Now, when they talk about 600, I don't know if they mean that they've paid them each an Electrum, but there, all of a sudden, that is, if they're paying each one an Electrum each, that, you know, immediately is what, 60 gold pieces. And, you know, that is... Sorry, I missed that.
No, I said it was quite a bit, so I wonder who's funding them.
Yes, exactly. And again, I keep thinking that this is something going from the Hierarchs, where they're no longer thinking about going to Wormhole or Warfields and fighting the Hierarchs, and they're now talking about going to attack 10 directly. That also, if that's true, it is the thinking of like the Hierarchs' planning is more subtle than, you know, because here they're thinking of, you know, some plan here, maybe of drawing down the strength or distracting 10, which is all the way across the other side of the Bandit Kingdoms. And, you know, not really in line with a direct host of Hierarchs, you know, army coming and attacking 10. So there's something afoot here. And, as we haven't finished, we haven't caught up to what is really going on. It's getting close to 7, so I'm going to break off here, and there's a little more that we see here. There's a little more setting detail. We're talked about Red Span. They mention the Zumkar River.
Red Span's north of Stoink on the Artansame as well.
Yes, and, you know, that Artansame is really, you know, a long, large, curving river. As you can see, there's also Longford is between them on the Artansame. And Longford would be a stopping point for barges, because if the river from Red Span down to Longsford doesn't have any other fords, then you would, transship goods and troops. You could barge them or boat them down from Red Span or from north, but you'd have to stop at Longsford and get into, another group of barges or boats to travel south from there. I believe that we also have, at the bottom of one of the curves there, we have Galesford, which would again be another break where, you know, you'd have to stop and shift from one boat or barge, pull it over the shallows. But if things are hard to, if the water's low enough that it's a ford, then it's unlikely that it's high enough to be easily able to pull a larger barge or boat over. So that would increase the, all those towns about, how busy they are, and what they would have to have. And, each one of these ford towns would be a very important point. If the Artansame is impossible to cross except at the fords, then these areas become very vital, because you see what a major river the Artansame is, how long it is, and, where it is going. That curve... we'd have to see where the everything seems to be draining down to the near div. So we don't have an elevation on the map here, but you would have to imagine that if everything is downriver, then we're seeing like a rise in elevation as you go proceed up from Radagast City and further up into the 10. That area must be like a rise in elevation. We have mentioned by Gord of the Flinties, where the Gambage meets, and talking about rating, and now none of that's true. That's just about Gord and his gray beggars there.
He was in the Flinties for a bit.
He was. I'm sorry, I missed that.
Yeah, but the beggars weren't. Yeah, when you're traveling along with the Atloy.
Oh, so he
went
was.
Across Iron, hit the Flinties, then went up into the Pale, and bounced around there a little bit.
You're right. I'd forgotten that. Yeah, this is really Gord is really doing a travelogue.
Yeah, he traveled about, like, in those two paragraphs in that book, he went about, like, over a quarter of the known Flannis, I think.
Yeah. I mean, he is, because, you know, we're traveling all the way up from the city of Greyhawk, and now he's, north of the Near Div, and he's gone a little to the east. He's crossed around the whole... I believe western and northern coasts of the Near Dev, and now he's moving back and forth through Nyron, the Pale, and now the Bandit Kingdoms, and up ahead it's going to be 10. So through the Ernst back and forth, so we're really getting a nice talk about various areas. Nothing too heavily detailed, although I will say that Stoink is getting a really heavy amount of detail.
It is. It's 7. I have to go.
All right. Well, I'm going to be ending for tonight. And it was, I'm ending on page 154. Good night. Thanks for being here.